From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, beginning with a look at events in Venezuela, where a pair of dueling plebiscites, one being sponsored by the government under the Constitution and the other by the opposition, seeking to thwart the government's efforts to amend the Constitution under the Constitution's provisions.
Yesterday, Sunday, there were two very important activities in terms of how the conflict in Venezuela is likely to be resolved. The most important activity, certainly from my point of view, was successful dry run, or simulacro is the Spanish word, and a kind of a test run for the Constituent Assembly, the National Constituent Assembly that's scheduled to vote for its candidates on July 30th. They're almost 600, I think it's 545, something like that, candidates, representing all sectors of Venezuelan society. That will be elected on July the 30th for a National Constituent Assembly that will agree changes to the Venezuelan Constitution to meet the current needs of Venezuelan society and economy.
Yeah, let me detail for a second, the problems that we're talking about here and also the context. You have, first of all, a provision for this under the current Venezuelan Constitution for, generate a constituent assembly to make adjustments to the Constitution as dictated by necessity of circumstance. And the circumstances we're talking about is president whose authority is being challenged by the members of the National Assembly, which is controlled by the opposition, where leaders of the opposition are openly calling for a military coup, for insurrection, for all kinds of strikes. There's a paralysis in the country as a consequence of this ongoing, the oppositional uprising, in essence. And so what they're looking to do is find a way for the government to be able to restore some order and allow the normal operation of society to take place. That's the context.
Yeah, thanks, Don. And of course, the other thing that the Venezuelan opposition are calling for, and they've stated this, leading representatives have stated this openly, they want foreign intervention in their favor.
Right.
So what the government has done is said, right, we have these very serious problems. We need to solve them peacefully. We want to solve them via dialogue and consensus. And that is why we think that constituent assembly is the best way to proceed, so that everybody in Venezuela can vote for their representatives to the Constituent Assembly and all sectors of Venezuelan society will be represented. That's the government position. And they're not trying to impose an agenda. They say that the issues currently facing the Venezuelan economy and society need to be addressed, but the Constituent Assembly will decide how that happens. Now, what the opposition have said is, and of course, the thing to remember about all that is that all of that, the whole process for the Constituent Assembly has happened within Venezuela's constitutional institutional framework. Now, by contrast, what the opposition have done is they said, no, we're not going to participate in the Constituent Assembly. What we're going to do is we're going to hold a popular consultation, a people's consultation, parallel to the process for the National Constituent Assembly. And we're convinced that that is going to give us a mandate to set up a parallel government.
Right. Now, if they wanted to do actually that particular referendum, what they could do, if they had the popular support, is have people run for the Constituent Assembly to make that a part of the change is made to the Constitution, make a provision for that under the Constitution, and then have that referendum.
Yeah, of course. Why are the opposition refusing to participate in the Constituent Assembly? Because they know they don't have a majority in the country.
Right.
And that is why. And that is why they're also, apparently, to date, they're refusing to take part in the regional election scheduled for December this year.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know that on the record, on their record, since they won the an overwhelming majority in the National Assembly back in, when was it, December 2015?
Yeah.
And ever since then, they've completely failed to convince the majority of the Venezuelan population that they are worthy candidates for government. And that, so their whole strategy is based on the fact that they don't have sufficient support. It's impossible to emphasize this too much.
Right.
They simply don't have majority support in Venezuela. And what the, whereas most people in Venezuela may disagree with Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues' government program, they actually support on specific issues like the economy and such like. They actually support well over 50% of the population support the government to see Venezuela through this current crisis. And well over 80% reject the violent tactics of the Venezuelan opposition.
Right.
And that is why the Venezuelan opposition have been forced to take this spurious, unconstitutional measure. They haven't, it's not ratified in any, it doesn't, the Venezuela's constitution doesn't contemplate anything like the kind of glorified opinion poll is what it is that the opposition held on Sunday, and it doesn't comply with any norms for anything like anything approaching the standard for a legitimate plebiscite or a legitimate election in any way, and it's wide open to abuse. They alleged this morning that 7 million people in Venezuela participated in their glorified opinion poll, but I mean that's an absurd figure. That's equivalent to the national turnout for an election. I think it was actually more than the turnout for the legislative elections back in 2015, which is one of the reasons why the government lost its majority in the legislature, is because there was massive abstention by people who normally support the government.
Right.
And so this 7 million figure that the opposition are quoting is completely absurd. It's just another example of their consistent dishonesty and mendacity. And they'll say anything to project an image of themselves as the legitimate representatives of the Venezuelan people, which they are not. So, the depressing thing about that is that on the basis of that spurious vote or spurious survey that they held on Sunday, international governments in the United States and Europe, principally, will say, oh, well, the Venezuelan opposition have a democratic mandate to set up a parallel government. And that is what is going to happen. It's very likely to happen. And that is how the whole process will be portrayed in the international corporate media. And it's a slightly more subtle version, not very much more subtle, of as we've said before, of what has happened in the past in Libya, Syria, and Ivory Coast, where a minority opposition is projected as having majority support falsely. And on the basis of that, the societies in those three countries were subject to vicious destabilization, currently still still happening in Libya and Syria. Those countries have been destroyed in many senses. Certainly Libya, although Syria has some hope of stabilizing itself under the leadership of President Assad. But in Venezuela, and I actually feel it's difficult to see whether one should be optimistic or pessimistic, because the result of the government's dry run yesterday was overwhelmingly successful. There was massive participation in that preparatory process, testing the voting system, getting people accustomed to the vote and the procedures for it. And they got massive support, whereas the opposition, although they say they got massive support, it's difficult, you know, it's impossible to verify. But the support for the Constituent Assembly seems to have been more solid than in previous processes, because it's standard practice in Venezuela to do a dry run prior to a major national electoral process. And apparently, the reports that I've read state that the Venezuelan government achieved a massive turnout in that dry run. So, you know, who has it? It comes down to that battles in two different senses. At a national level, it's very clear that the government is doing better than the opposition.
Right.
But at an international level, the opposition are winning the propaganda war because they have the support of all the NATO country governments and all the NATO country mass media.
You know, I'm looking at the numbers here. You've got, in the 2015 election, they had, it was a total of 13,742,000, roughly, split like 7,700,000 to 5,600,000, and now they're claiming yesterday about 7 million showed up, and 99.87% or 99.9% in essence voted yes, to ignore the Constituent Assembly. In other words, to take the opposition's position, which is about the same vote that they had in the National Assembly. In other words, the only people that took place in their little poll yesterday were their constituents, the people who are, you know, support the opposition. And that no one who supports the government, which is the other half of the population and then some, didn't take part in it. That's all that this means. and they're using that as it's going to be, as you're saying, going to be the fodder for their argument that they should set up a parallel government.
There's so many arguments against taking the opposition exercise seriously, and what you just said is very clearly the case, that only their people turned out to vote for them. But the thing about that is, I certainly don't take that 7 million figure seriously. But I mean, that's, you can argue about that forever, right, can't you? But the nitty gritty is that their process was hopelessly vitiated by anomalies, nobody can check the results because they right. said beforehand that they were going to destroy the electoral records after the vote.
Right.
You know, and it's just absurd. No, if it were not the Venezuelan opposition, no government would ratify that process. And the corporate media, what would have happened if it had been the other way around, if the Venezuelan government had engaged in that process?
Right.
The corporate media would have skewed it. They'd have rubbished it. So, you know, and that, just another example of the double standards that apply in the coverage of international foreign affairs, isn't it? So the fundamental question is, what will happen between now and July the 30th? Will the Venezuelan opposition continue to try and intensify their violent tactics across the country? Or will they wait and see what happens with the Constituent Assembly? And the likelihood is that they'll do their utmost to try and provoke more widespread violence. That's the likelihood. They'll probably set up a spurious alternative government and try and get international recognition for it. And so that they can then say, well, the Constituent Assembly doesn't represent the Venezuelan people. So what's likely to happen after July the 30th is a continuing standoff. But the nitty-gritty for the Venezuelan opposition is that they do not have a majority. And that will become clearer and clearer as months go by. The Constituent Assembly is likely to be a great success. The Venezuelan constitution will be changed whether the Venezuelan opposition participate or not. And those changes will strengthen the hand of the government to deal with the economic sabotage and the street violence the Venezuelan opposition have been using to project themselves and destabilize the country. So that by the time the December regional elections come around, and it's likely that the Venezuelan opposition, they'll be nowhere politically in national terms. And what's likely to happen is that as the momentum of the changes in the as a result of the Constituent Assembly accumulates in favor of the government's program to address the current destabilization that mainly the United States has been promoting via its proxies in the Venezuelan opposition. And the Venezuelan opposition will lose support and be reduced to their core support, which is around 25 to 30% of the population. So what will happen then? Well, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the situation is bad there. The conditions are essentially a consequence of the economic warfare that's been conducted against the country by the United States primarily and by the comprador bourgeoisie in the country. And also an information war, basically a political propaganda war being conducted by the corporate media, which control the bulk of the airwaves and print media in the country, which is a similar condition to that which exists in Brazil and Argentina and other places that have been going through similar crises. The people who are clamoring from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights all the way to the characters in U.S. Congress for democracy and democratic institutions, have this parody of those things going on, for example, in Brazil right now with the most crooked people in the country lifted into office by process over the will of the electorate, and the electorate is being denied further choice by every type of political and character assassination that can be conducted, as, for example, is being done to Lula right now.
Yeah, and it seems to me, John, that there's a regional process. We can identify a regional process that's happening. And maybe I'm simplifying too much, but it just seems to me that in countries like Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, and these are countries where between 2002 and 2013, say, roughly, progressive governments radically improved the economic and social position of their the people of their impoverished majorities in their countries. Mm-hmm. Then what happened was that there was a downturn in international prices. The right wing kind of dress themselves up and deck themselves out to look more attractive than they have in the past. And they were able to point to a slowdown in an economic slowdown that they attributed to the policies of the progressive governments. And so the floating voters, you're probably in any of those countries, you've probably got 30% of the population who aren't politically aligned one way or another. And so what happened in Argentina, we saw this in Argentina, to a lesser extent we've seen it in Brazil, and it's also very clearly happening in Venezuela, that the progressive governments in those countries suffered as a result of the global economic slowdown and the way the right wing were able to project themselves in that context. But now, so the floating voters drifted to the right. But now what's happening is that in Venezuela, in Brazil, in Argentina, the people who voted for the right wing without being politically aligned are seeing that the right wing are completely hopeless. They have no strategy. In fact, their strategy is designed to attack the impoverished majorities and the majorities in those countries economically. Certainly you can see that in Argentina, where something like 1.6 million people have fallen into unemployment since and into poverty since Mauricio Macri took power there. And so what we're seeing now is that while in Brazil and in Argentina the right wing political parties and the sectors of society that they represent are currently in power, there's a massive rejection of them at a popular level that's likely to be reflected if those countries are able to engage in genuinely democratic elections over the next 2 or 3 years.
Right.
And we're likely to see in Argentina, all the signs are that there'll be a strong reaction against Mauricio Macri's government in the legislative elections scheduled for whenever it is. I think it's November this year. And in Lula, despite being sentenced to jail by this judge called Sergio Mora, who's been responsible for corruption investigations for the last 3 or 4 years, and despite that, a great majority of people in Brazil reject that sentence. They reject it as based on unsatisfactory evidence, on a process that's vitiated with errors and obviously politicized decisions. So, and most people in Brazil support Lula for the presidency in 2018. So, and what we're seeing in Venezuela is something similar. So, and what we're seeing is that well over 50% of the population believe that President Nicolas Maduro is the person best able to resolve Venezuela's current crisis. So in that regional context, in that continental context, the right wing is at a disadvantage, and it remains to be seen how they'll react.
Yeah.
And my feeling is that unless they go for outright civil war in Venezuela, they will be reduced to a nationally important but still minority section of the country's political life in Venezuela. And we're likely to see similar processes in Argentina and Brazil over the next year.
You know, just for a little context again, you know, this was a judge, right, of a bench trial of Lula. And Sergio Moro, the judge, is an appointee of a prominent opposition figure now, but then the president, Fernando Henrique Cardoza, in 1996. Clearly a political appointment. Moro was out of law school a year at the point that he gets appointed to the Supreme Court, or to the high court there. He's been ruling on these cases. It's been the enabling political process for the coup d'etat that removed Dilma Rousseff, and now they're looking to remove Lula as a essentially as the winning candidate in the 2018 elections in Brazil. In other words, he's been conducting a witch hunt as an appointee of the right wing, which is still counting among its leaders that particular president and or ex-president. And what they're doing is that they're purging the Socialist Party out of the political life of Brazil, despite the fact that they've won the last three or four elections.
Yeah, so and the nitty-gritty there is that the Brazilian justice system works very slowly. So unless they do, unless they treat the case against Lula in a special way, and he's going to appeal. His lawyers are going to appeal, and that could take anything between 18 months and 2 years to come to a result.
Right, past the presidential election, and meanwhile he's barred from running for office.
No. And until there's a firm conviction,
right.
If it's on appeal, he still has his political rights.
Right.
So he can participate in the election, and if he does get elected president, even though that process is in appeal, nothing can happen to him. He enjoys immunity until the end of his presidential office.
Ah, that's interesting. Okay, so it's going to be hanging over his head, but he's going to be allowed to participate. Okay.
Yeah. Now the appeals court, the superior court to Sergio Moro, has said that they intend to judge the appeal before the presidential elections next year. Mm. Will they or won't they? We don't know.
Right.
And what is likely to happen on appeal? Well, 54% of cases that Moro has of people that Moro has condemned have won their cases on appeal and overturned Moro's judgment. So. And there's a very strong chance that Lula will win his appeal prior to the elections, and there's also a strong chance that the appeal process will drag out and not have run its course prior to the election. So, but in any case, that's the nitty gritty of the process, right? But in any case, for the Brazilian elites, for the right-wing Brazilian elites who are so used to getting their way, Lula represents a permanent problem. And
yeah.
He's a figure of such enormous stature in the country, in Brazil, that even if he isn't able to run, and the person that he supports will enjoy huge support, and electoral support, popular support in Brazil, to the extent that they're like, even if it isn't Lula that is the presidential candidate, people will still vote for the person that Lula says is right. should be the presidential candidate for the Workers' Party.
Yeah, and I think that's good. We're going to have to watch and see how that develops. All right, so Tony, I want to pick up next week on whatever developments occur in Venezuela, and particularly some of the international activity around it. But I also want to get to your piece next week that you wrote about Nicaragua, and I think maybe we'll start there. So thanks a lot for your time, as usual.
Okay, and maybe we'll have time to talk about the forest of Sao Paulo as well.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Okay, thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.